Hyundai is coming, and the project is going to change Savannah's economy forever. So says Georgia Southern economist Michael Toma. The good professor and I unpack what Hyundai's auto plant and EV battery factory will mean for the region on this episode of the Commute Podcast. Good day from all of us here at SavannahNow.com. This is the Commute Podcast presented by National Office Systems, and I am your host, Adam Van Brimmer, opinion columnist and a deputy editor at Savannah Morning News. On this edition of The Commute, a follow-up to my recent discussion with Georgia Southern economics professor Michael Toma, this time with an eye toward the opening of the Hyundai plant in Bryan County, and how we need to be preparing for this latest economic driver right now. But first, a word about our sponsor, National Office Systems. National Office Systems has been The Commute's benefactor since the podcast start, and they've been in business long before that, since the 1980s, in fact. In those early days, National Office Systems was the last office outfitter in the country to carry office furniture from both of the industry's leaders, Herman Miller and Knoll. Now, a couple of decades later, those furniture companies are collaborating in a new product line, and National Office Systems is one of the first to offer Miller Knoll furniture. In addition to Miller Knoll, National Office Systems remains the leader in the office design and outfitting sector, offering Dirt Modular Interiors, Caliphus Furniture, and 200 other product lines. Learn more by visiting www.natoffsys.com. That's www.natoffsys.com. Now, here's the Hyundai discussion with Michael Toma.
Quarterly check-in on the Savannah economy by Toma. Professor of Economics at Georgia Southern University on the Armstrong campus. And as listeners know, and as Michael knows, I have an interest in economics, and I know just enough to be dangerous. About 40% of what I think is true on average. And Michael is here to correct me and get everything the real lowdown. So, Michael, let's start broad and then come down to the local level. Broad, everybody right now is talking about inflation. People ask me about inflation. Oh, gosh, how bad is this? And I'm like, well, at the same time, look at the labor market. Unemployment's really, really low. Wages are rising. There's one legacy of the pandemic. It's that we are short on supply in everything. So I'm not panicked about inflation. Am I wrong to not be panicked about inflation?
Inflation is sometimes referred to, I think, as the most insidious tax. I think that's a quote from Ronald Reagan, because its adverse effects tend to fall most heavily on individuals with fixed incomes and individuals with lower incomes who are spending more of their take-home income from their jobs and such on consumer goods, basic consumer staples like gas, groceries, and all those things. Exactly. So, I think panic is not quite the right word. I think concerned. I don't think we should just brush away the adverse effects of inflation, particularly because they fall so heavily on lower income households and households on fixed incomes, retirees and such that are trying to live on a fixed pension and Social Security. So, it is meritorious for policymakers to think about ways to reduce the inflation rate. The inflation that we're seeing right now, yesterday's report, I think 9.1% on the consumer side, and today's report, 10.3% for inputs that manufacturers, producers need to conduct their operations. Those are 40-year highs. And they're slightly worse than they were than the May report for both consumer and producer inflation. So those numbers are beginning to become ingrained a little bit in terms of inflation, and that sets up what's referred to as an inflationary spiral, in the sense that if employers know that their inputs are going to cost more, and workers know that their dollars aren't going as far as they were in the past, workers are going to start to negotiate for higher wages. Employers are going to know that and anticipate their labor costs are going to rise. And then, to the extent that producers can, those prices, rising prices effectively become a self-fulfilling process prophecy, because the employers have to account for higher wages in the prices of the products that they produce and offer to consumers. So, you know, we see this inflationary spiral potentially starting to take root. And I think that probably has the Federal Reserve highly concerned, is that the inflation that we're seeing is no longer transitory. It's potentially becoming entrenched, and that's a deeper economic problem, a harder economic problem for the Fed to solve. You know, the Fed is in some senses limited in what it can do to reduce inflation. It effectively has to take out the demand side of the economy, or certainly tamp it down in terms of its strength. And, you know, we saw this explosion of consumer expending post-COVID, in the sense that we're sort of post-COVID, we're post-lockdown, right? But we're not exactly post-COVID at this point. So consumer spending, particularly in services, you know, accelerated very rapidly. And so that's when we talk about demand, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. The Fed has the ability to tamp that down by raising interest rates. That affects everybody in terms of consumers, with your mortgage rates and your auto loan rates and your consumer credit card interest rates. Fed policy indirectly affects all of those. And so that type of activity will get dampened down in the economy, and it also makes it more costly for firms to borrow. And so their investment in capital goods is also going to weaken as a result of that. So that's the private side of the economy, right? That's consumers, and that's private businesses' investment. And so that demand is going to be, you know, reduced somewhat in the broad macro economy, and it should slowly begin to erode inflation. Now, the difficulty that the Fed is facing right now is that the inflation that we see is not strictly its fault from quantitative easing of 5 years ago and 3 years ago to address a really weak economy. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Is you know, if the Fed, you know, folks, it's fashionable to beat up on the Fed, right? Right. It's the Fed's fault, right? The Fed printed, you know, pallets of money. First of all, the Fed doesn't print money. The Treasury Department does. And second, well, how can we explain the logic to me in which quantitative easing from 5 years ago caused inflation today? Right. So that link, maybe there's a contributing factor there. But why the 5 year lag? That, you know, that doesn't quite add up in my view. In addition, you know, let's not completely absolve the Fed of everything, right? Because the Fed, you know, didn't act as fast as many people hoped it would act when inflation started to build. But you've also got all these supply side factors that are really constraining the ability of firms to produce what people want to buy. And so, you know, if you constrain the supply side, right, if you limit supply, just in the very broadest sense, less supply given any amount of demand means higher prices. And so you've got manufacturing supply side constraints emerging in China because their approach to COVID is different than it is in the US or Western Europe. You've got logistic problems in terms of moving goods around within the country and also getting goods into the country on the global fleet of container vessels and other types of freighters. That's, you know, causes the just the price of moving, it causes an increase in the cost of moving things, getting stuff onto the shelves in Target and Walmart and wherever, into the grocery store wherever you buy things. It costs more to put that stuff on the shelf because of these supply constraints, and transportation costs are increased, fuel prices are increased. The war in Ukraine didn't happen because the Federal Reserve did or didn't act. That happened. That was an exogenous outside factor. So, you know, while it's fashionable to beat up on the Fed, there's certainly far more things that are going on in the macro economy that are outside of the Fed's controls. And the policy that the Fed has at its disposal to influence the macro economy is really limited to just the demand side of the economy. The Fed can't fix supply side problems, which are just permeating through the economy right now. So, right, what does that mean? That means inflation is going to be with us for a while, I think, until we start to see supply side factors dissipate, until the transportation logistics chains begin to work more smoothly, perhaps as you know, if the conflict, the war in Ukraine is resolved within the next 6 to 12 months, you know, that should have an impact on global commodity prices and reduce prices in those markets. So, do I think we're going to be at 10% inflation and 9% inflation a year from now? No, not at all. I think we'll start to see inflation rates slowly begin to drift down through the remaining portion of this year. But if we manage to get to 6% inflation by December, that will be considered a success. It's unlikely that the inflation rate will still be 10% by the end of this year, but that really doesn't, you know, consumers who are dealing with visibly every time you go to the grocery store, you're visibly in, you know, you see the increase in the cost of the prices of the things that you're buying. And so, you know, consumers are going to be stressed through the remainder of the year with higher prices. You know, at least on the plus side here in our regional economy, wages, at least through the first quarter data, wages are increased significantly to help, you know, offset that. On the private sector, the wage growth from the first quarter of 2021 to the first quarter of 2022 was really spectacular, almost 14%. That's not sustainable. That's not going to be the case in second quarter data. It was a lot of catching up, because through the first half of last year, when nationwide wage rates were increasing by 5 or 6 percentage points, our wages were flat in our three county metro area. So there's a little bit of a catch up going on here. And I think what we'll see in the second quarter data is much more moderate, probably on the order of that national rate of 5 or 6%. Again, that sounds good, right? Your wages are up by 5 or 6%, but that's not so great if inflation is 9%, right? You're still losing ground. So households are still going to be stressed, particularly the low-income households and households living on fixed incomes.
It closed the loop on inflation. It's going to be a tough needle to thread, right? Bring inflation down seeing unemployment jump up. Some of the factors we got going on here, I don't necessarily think here, but might be elsewhere. How does the broader economy, how do we thread that needle to meet these inflation demands without seeing a bunch of people back on the board?
Pardon the interruption here. I promise you we'll get back to Hyundai and Savannah and the discussion with economics professor Michael Toma here in a moment. In the meantime, though, allow me to squeeze in a public service announcement regarding the Savannah Morning News. I know a lot of readers out there consume our news content in the print edition. First, thank you. We love you for it. Keep doing it. But we'd also like to encourage you to take a moment, go to your computer or cell phone, and join our digital communities. At SavannahNow.com, you can activate the digital side of your subscription by logging in through the link at the top right-hand corner of the homepage. And on mobile, you can download our app, log in, and have access, including notifications. That's if you want. Sometimes I find it a little pesky, but it's also good to know when news is breaking. And on mobile, you can download our app, log in, and have access to all of our content. You can even get notifications if you prefer. Sometimes it's good to know exactly when news is breaking. Again, access to those platforms are included in your print subscription price.
The ability to perfectly set the interest rate to just perfectly make demand diminish enough, but not enough so that everybody loses their job, kind of thing. That's an understatement, of course. But that's the tough part. And the Fed is in some senses in uncharted waters here with all these supply side factors. And we haven't seen inflation like this in 40 years. So, you know, folks who are working at the Fed, you know, most of those folks who lived through that experience are long since retired and gone on their way. And so the professional experience is more limited in terms of, hey, what do we do about this? What can we do? What can we hope to meaningfully, you know, implement that has an effect on inflation? So threading the needle, I think, is going to be tough because the Fed's policy tools are really limited in an environment of supply constraints. Anything that the Fed does at this point is going to have an effect on employment, and at the margin pushes us closer towards job losses and a recession. I don't think it would be a deep recession. I think it would be more of a mild recession, primarily because of the shortage and the labor market shortage. Our labor markets are really tight. We are at a historically low unemployment rate, both nationally and regionally. So if the unemployment rate does rise, which it will some, a reasonable estimate might be somewhere, 5%, possibly 6%. But I don't think much more beyond that, simply because labor markets are so tight right now. So most of what I'm, seeing and thinking about on my own is that, we're looking at probably a mild recession. And that's, I think, probably the best that we can hope for, given the increasingly entrenched level inflation in the economy that makes the Fed's job more difficult, which means it has to restrict money supply growth more than it had anticipated even 3 to 4 months ago. So now, with the release of the inflation rate yesterday, market participants in the financial sector, they're anticipating not only a 0.75 percentage point increase at the next Fed meeting, which is in several weeks, but even a possibility of a full percentage point increase in the federal funds rate, which would be unprecedented. A 0.75 percentage point increase from the last cycle was unprecedented in and of itself, but at least it tied, right? It kind of tied the highest rate increase that we've ever seen. A 1 percentage point increase has the potential to really influence equity markets, because that would be a surprise in some senses, because the Fed has never done that before. But I think it's probably more likely that we'll see a 0.75 point increase in the federal funds rate the next cycle for the Fed meeting. So
borrow money now.
Those interest rates will continue to drift up. So, and kind of closing the loop, Fed policy is more likely to push us towards a recession, but it won't be a deep recession on a national level, simply because labor markets are so tight.
Right. I'm going to come back to labor locally. We'll talk about cut day down the road, but let's stay with supply side and talk about what's going on at the ports. The monitor noted that the container moves are slowing. Of course, last year we had a lot of ships that couldn't get in and offload, and there was a backup of containers. A lot of that has eased, but when we see stuff slowing, is that just there's fewer ships offloading, or is it farther down the supply chain that's getting blocked up and that's slowing stuff on?
There are a lot of complications right now in the whole logistics and transportation network on a nationwide basis. The ports connect to the nation's rail systems, and the rail systems are backing up because there's a shortage of carriages. And there's a shortage of carriages available to put all those containers on. There's a shortage of those carriages because it's difficult to offload the carriages in our rail facilities because there's a shortage of labor. And so everything begins to back up. It's difficult to get containers from the West Coast of, Los Angeles, Long Beach port to Chicago, for example. So we move lots of stuff from our ports to the interior portion of the country, primarily on the rail system. And so there's backups throughout that system. And so if there's a shortage of carriages, that means it's harder to put containers onto the carriages, which means the containers are going to stay in the rail transshipment points, and in the ports on a longer term basis than they normally would. So a container might sit on a port facility, generally maybe say, let's say a week, and now it might be sitting in a port facility for 10 to 12 days. Right, because there's not the capacity to move those containers throughout the entire logistics network. So combine that with slowing global growth too. So if economic growth is slowing somewhat, because the United States is not the only country that's feeling these macroeconomic problems, that's a global thing. There would be less shipping on the global lines, in terms of across the oceans and all that stuff. So I think it's worth, kind of keeping a close eye on port activity. it's too soon to say with one quarter's worth of data, you know, because of, you know, the way the monitor is constructed and the way the language is written in that report, it's a comparison primarily to the previous quarter. So a one quarter change in which things kind of, you know, kind of step back and take a deep breath and kind of get recharged, maybe that's what's happening. You know, so one quarter does not set a trend. Let's keep our eye on the port. You know, generally speaking, port activity has been solid and strong and is likely to continue to be solid and strong in the future. Let's see what the second quarter numbers look like. I think the early data that we have for the second quarter looks very promising in terms of recovery and continued growth. But so there's certainly nothing to panic about that with respect to, right. No, that's what I was saying. It's just, I think there's just a kind of a one quarter little bump. And we'll see what it looks like in the second quarter, but I don't think there's any reason to be concerned about port activity whatsoever in the long run.
Housing, you look at permits and construction starts. And of course, we know we have a housing shortage here. As it is, we see the stuff in the paper, the apartment complexes, mega subdivisions. That one down at Richmond Hill's got 10,000 houses. Construction and housing, from what you're seeing from all the data, are we going to be able to keep up? Will you be able to catch up and then keep up?
Right. The first part is catching up. It will be difficult because of the limited availability of labor in the construction trades. Right. It's always coming back to labor, right? Which is, you know, in a very broad picture, construction trades, and industrial type trades, whether, welding or plumbing or carpentry, the workforce in those sectors is aging out, right? With the baby boomers retiring and, the folks with a whole entire career's worth of knowledge are beginning to retire and have been retiring for the past 10 years. And in terms of the pipeline of individuals being attracted, the young folks who would otherwise be attracted into that sector, that supply pipeline of individuals is drying up. So the amount of knowledge and experience that we're losing in those trade sectors is stunning, and we're not developing, suitable replacements in terms of the volume that we need to support significant and huge and continued growth in housing and construction. So I think we're constrained on the supply side. Would builders like to build more homes? Absolutely, right? The demand is present. It's easy to see. It's impossible not to see the additional demand for housing, and whether that's single family homes or multifamily units, apartment complexes, et cetera. It's just that the labor that isn't required to build those residential structures, it's not there. We're seeing some slow increase in construction employment, but believe it or not, we are still around 1,300-1,400 jobs below the amount of construction employment that we had at the peak of the housing boom back in 2005 and 2006. We had over 10,000 people employed in the construction sector, and we're only still at 8,700 now. So we're still just what that means, right, is that we simply don't have the labor to expand housing at the rate that we were 15 years ago, right? So would we like to build them? Sure. The catch-up process is going to be difficult. We can authorize building permits all we want. I think across the river, is it Hampton and Jasper County combined? I think, maybe as long as 5 or 10 years ago, they had authorized the issuance of up to, I think it was 100,000 permits. It was an ungodly amount of permits, but that just because the government authorizes those permits to be issued doesn't mean they're going to happen overnight, right? So in the long run, it's going to be a game of catch up. And what that means is that the housing prices are going to remain elevated, and rental market prices are going to remain elevated too, as people get priced out of the housing market. We have significant in-migration from folks who are coming from housing markets in which the median price of a home is higher than it is here. And so folks coming down to our or into our market from wherever they're coming from, you know, they may be looking at our housing prices and go, "Ooh, that's very reasonable. I want to buy one. Well, I'll buy two." Well, you know, they may not be buying two, but still the idea is that, you know, on a relative basis, our housing is still relatively less expensive than it is in, say, the New England market in general. And so our home prices look very attractive to those individuals. So it's, I don't see a housing market crash in our local economy. I see maybe the rate of appreciation in prices slowing, but I don't, at this point, I don't see the fundamentals being in place for a 2008, 2009, 10 housing market crash. I just don't see that. That was a very different set of fundamental economic circumstances than we are observing right now.
You touched on my fear. And that's the whole idea, as interest rates rise and if the Fed pushes up another 3/4 or a whole point, your mortgage rates right now, I think, are in the 30-year. Right. You know, if they push higher, that's going to mean a lot of people that want to buy a house can no longer afford to buy a house, which means they're going to be renting. We've already got a rental shortage that's going to drive rental prices up. That's kind of what I sit here and scratch my head about, how that could be dealt with. We can see people basically living further out, but we can see a lot of roommate situations. There's going to be a lot of, there's already a lot of that.
No.
Does that accelerate or expand?
I think so. Right. You know, you'll end up doubling up. You'll see a lot of what I think they're called households in which you have unrelated adults living with each other, which is the roommate situation. We'll see more of that. And the way that it works in real estate is the further away you are from the urban core, the lower the land prices are. So you trade commuting costs for land prices as you, you know, commuting costs go up as land prices move down further away from the core. You'll see more development in outlying areas where the land prices and home prices are going to be lower than they are closer in. So, you know, to the extent that that exacerbates the situation for, you know, workforce development housing, that makes it harder for the market to bring within close proximity to the urban core. It makes it harder for the market to bring what's referred to as affordable housing. That's going to be an ever-increasing strain in the housing market. That's not going to go away. That's a longer-term problem that we'll have to figure out how to solve.
That's all for this episode of the Commute Podcast. Thanks one last time to our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Before I sign off, remember that we publish new Commute episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Whatever your interests, you will find interviews of interest in our archives. Search The Commute with That Savannah Opinion on your favorite podcast app. The Commute returns soon. We look forward to talking to you then. Goodbye.